What I want to spend a little bit of time talking about is an evaluation system that I set up to evaluate some health and safety training for the Center to Protect Workers' Rights. More recently, what they brought me in to do was to evaluate some new green construction training that they have recently implemented. This training is tailored for minority workers, but the training evaluation system that I'm presenting today could be used on a variety of health and safety training, but you'll certainly be seeing it within the context of green construction and minority workers with respect to my results today. What I'm going to spend a little bit of time doing, other than describing the evaluation, is also describing the results of the multiple stakeholder evaluation with respect to program effectiveness in preparing these participants to meet these new workforce demands that we've been discussing this morning. And then to discuss the implications of using this evaluation system in assessing the effectiveness of related health and safety training interventions. Okay. The training that I'm going to be talking about today was provided by the Center to, formerly the Center to Protect Workers' Rights, now the Center for Construction Research and Training. It is one of the largest private organizations in the world developed to provide construction health and safety training. And since 1999, it has administered the Minority Worker Training Program funded by NIHS. And in that capacity, it trains, certifies, and secures jobs for ethnic minorities living in or around Brownsfield or EPA Superfund sites. So we're talking about their target population tends to be unemployed and underemployed minority youth. The green courses were created to address critical workforce development issues directly affecting these disadvantaged worker populations. The thought here is you're taking individuals from the community, training them, and then they in turn go back into those communities. CPWR, and what I'll be talking about is these MWT programs today, serves as the foundation for offering green construction training to this target population most impacted by the recession. So their thought was the green construction training is going to prepare these community residents to enter the emerging green blue-collar workforce. So there were two main courses that they worked on when they first started rolling out these green courses. And one was the introduction to green building. It was originally structured as a 40-hour green building awareness level course. And it consisted primarily of lectures and videos. And the topics included, but were not limited to, things such as sustainable construction, houses as passive systems, energy efficiency, resource conservation, and indoor air quality. There was a second course that they also rolled out during this initial phase, and that was the home weatherization construction. Again, a 40-hour course. This one, however, was lecture and hands-on. They had a large hands-on component to this. And it was presented in the context of new construction and retrofitting. And topics included whole house weatherization techniques, including blower doors, air scaling, and insulation. So the general purpose of the evaluation process that I came in to evaluate these programs or assess these programs' effectiveness was in the context of a larger evaluation system. I was brought in as a third-party evaluator to look at, in general, how these MWT programs were effective in meeting the five NIEHS criteria. So there was a larger evaluation system in place that I was then putting the green course evaluation into. The other thing that was important for you to understand is that when I was putting together the MWT program evaluation, one of the things we looked at also was the impact on the students, on the communities in which they reside and eventually go back to work in, and also on the field of environmental work. And then within that larger framework, I evaluated the effectiveness of these newly developed green courses that I just talked about a second ago. The system that I'm talking about today is an integrated programmatic evaluation. And what I mean by that is it's really a sort of a two-pronged evaluation system. One is it looks at impact evaluation. And those are designed, some of you may be familiar with this, to measure what effects the program had on its intended goals and objectives. This tends to be more quantitative or hard number data. How many folks were trained? What was your goal? Did you meet that goal? It's more numerical than the process evaluation, which was the second prong. And that is really evaluations that tend to be more qualitative in nature. And those are designed so that how did you arrive at those numbers? It's the how and the why behind what effects you had. What we have found, and this we've used this evaluation for several years now, what we've found is the why and how part, that qualitative information, really gives meaning to those numbers and gives a greater understanding when you're trying to create best practices and continuous improvement in the program. And we wanted to make sure that we were doing that when we evaluated the green courses as well. The evaluation system that we used is based upon a 360 evaluation feedback process. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. When I first started talking about this process, most folks in public health had no idea what I was talking about. Private industry has been using this for a long time. And essentially, just as the name implied, it's a full 360 loop. It's a multi-rater or multi-source system where you go at those key stakeholders in the training program. So when we're talking about these MWT programs, we're talking about the students, the community advisory committee, the instructors, the program coordinators, and then the director of the specialized training program. But essentially, the information from one of those sources is supplemented with another source. You don't just do this for quantitative data, you also do it for the qualitative data, and then you integrate all that information. The idea behind it is you get a more thorough and accurate depiction of what's really going on with the training, because everyone that comes into the training with their own lens. The community advisory committee is going to have a different perspective than the students, and it's going to have a different perspective than the instructors, but all those perspectives are necessary to have a greater understanding of the impact of that program and how to improve it, particularly when we're talking about the development of courses at this formative stage. So the three sources for the 360 evaluation, when you think of 360 in industry, typically the thing in the yellow box would be the worker. And then you'd talk to the worker's supervisor, their peers, their direct reports, the staffs. But when we talk about sources for the 360 evaluation with the context of a training program, the training program is that target or that center box. So then you get information based on all those key stakeholders, as I just said, the students, the director of specialized training programs. In this case, this director had knowledge of all four MWT programs, so she had a very different lens as well. But then each of the program coordinators that are leading the program were also evaluated, and then the community advisory committee. One thing that I want to comment about with the students is, if you're thinking about using students as evaluation sources, please keep two things in mind. The current students and the graduated students have a very different perspective, and each is very unique and each is very valuable in its own way. The current students are going to be able to tell you, obviously, what's going on in the classroom at the time, and that's important if you change the curriculum, if you've brought in a new instructor, et cetera. But those graduated students are really going to tell you a better idea of impact, because they are going to be the ones in the workplace that are now transferring that knowledge onto real hands-on, where the rubber meets the road kind of work. So if you're considering using students, I encourage you to try to consider using both of those groups in your evaluation, because they will give you very different information. Now, when you talk about a multiple stakeholder evaluation, when I talk about this, people are like, oh yeah, that's a great idea, I think I want to implement that. Just be aware, multiple stakeholders and multiple sources mean multiple methods, because you're going to have to, in gathering this information, you want to gather it in such a way, or I always try to gather it in such a way, that you're putting the least amount of burden that you can on your information sources. The easier you make it for them, the more likely you're going to get good information back. So the program coordinators have sort of a twofold type process, where they have a written questionnaire. Some of them like to do it electronically. I tell them, you can either mail it back to me or you can just type it in. But it's followed up with a site visit, where I actually go on site and have an interview with them. The director of specialized training program, as I said, that's the individual that knows all the training programs fairly intimately, not just one specific one like the program coordinators do. So typically that's done in an interview, and that's the last step of my process. The community advisory committees are a great source of information. what I try to do for them. Some of them like electronics, some of them that's a little too high tech, they like written. But what we do is typically we have the program coordinators, when they have a community advisory committee, they will then at that point, and it's typically during a site visit that I'm attending, will have me talk a little bit about the evaluation and literally right then hand out the evaluation forms. Some of them like to take them home and type them in electronically, which is fine, but I encourage you, if you're going to use community advisory committees, many of these folks serve on more than one board. So when you're having them fill out an evaluation about a specific program or a specific aspect of the program, it really is beneficial if it's done in an advisory committee meeting where they talk about that aspect of the program, and then the community advisory committee is then giving you direct feedback with direct knowledge of that program in mind when they're evaluating it. That's quite helpful. The other thing, as I said, current and graduated students, I do focus groups during my site visits with them. I hold two different sessions. The current students and the graduated students have a very different perspective, and in order to keep that sort of streamlined and to keep that uniqueness to it, I hold separate focus group sessions with the current students and then the graduated students. And in all honesty, the graduated students are typically working, so it's a different time frame. The current students, they pull them out of a training course, I meet with them during the day. The graduated students, I meet with them in the evening. So the green training courses that I just talked about, the CPWR provided, had two training cycles completed at the time that I was gathering evaluation data. They had 80 students trained in these green courses, and at the time when I gathered the final data, 56 of the students are employed, which is quite impressive given the current economic status of the various cities that we were talking about. This gives you an idea of the type of information that I asked about the green courses. This is from the Community Advisory Committee survey that I administered to that group of folks. And they answered questions such as, program effectively provides green courses for environmental cleanup. And what you'll see is there were quite high ratings across the programs. What you'll notice, and one thing that I think is very useful for the programs and for feedback, is I always have a don't know option. I think that's very useful in terms of getting feedback from community advisory folks, because that gives the program coordinators some insight into, if you have a fairly high percentage, like in the St. Paul program of 18.2, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but that signals or highlights the fact that though you may want to do a better job of conveying your message or communicating with those folks in the community advisory committee. So that information really does, in terms of evaluating the program, just gives you sort of a heads up if you see a fairly high percentage of maybe that they're not using that community advisory group to the extent that they could with respect to getting feedback about their courses. The other thing that you will see with 360 systems that, such as what I'm trying to present here today, is this is in respect to what extent the training influenced program graduates. Now, what you'll see here is, and consistently what we find with the CPWR programs, these ratings are quite high, and there's quite a lot of convergence among the ratings. And what I mean by convergence is everybody's basically saying that these programs are influencing to strongly influencing their students. That's across sites, and that more importantly, that's across stakeholder opinions. That's a very powerful message to send back to the programs, the program coordinators, and the director of specialized training, because what we're seeing is that they are consistently rated highly by all the stakeholders, and importantly, by those community advisory committees, many of whom are the individuals that they may be working for, and the students themselves, which are the direct customers of the training. You can also look at this over time. The way the system is set up, every 2 years we go back in and evaluate, so I'll be able to look at training impact over time and the impact of these courses over time. But along with the impact data or the quantitative data, we also look at the qualitative data. This is asking about, just more in general, the strong aspects of the training, and why do you feel that, the why behind it, why do you feel they achieve these results? And what we find consistently is there's certain aspects of the training within these populations that tend to make them consistently effective across sites. You got to remember, these are four sites, so we find when we see a lot of convergence with the qualitative data across sites, we feel that we have identified best practices for these particular target audiences. And what you'll see is consistently we find that the life skills training, which the CPWR does an excellent job and devotes a lot of time to this, the life skills training is quite important. The hands-on aspect, which we know from worker training, is very important. And they also need a fair amount of student support because of the issues that they have coming into the training itself. I mimicked this when we looked at the green courses. And again, because this is the introduction of the green courses, this is more formative in nature. But what are the most important aspects? And then how could these green courses be improved? And what I saw, if you look again across sources, we're seeing a consistent message, is that the job-related aspects were quite important. It not only increased the perspective of the training of the trainees, of allowing them to see that they were more the knowledges that they wanted to gain, they were actually the students that I interviewed were quite interested in this topic area. They really saw it as the way of the future. But they themselves felt like it broadened their own knowledge base, but also consistently we saw across stakeholders, it broadened the range of job opportunities for them once they got out and tried to actually find a job and get into the workplace. Again, this was happening during the recession and many of these communities were having trouble finding jobs, and they felt like it broadened the potential job base for them, because what we found from the Community Advisory Committee was the organizations were stressing these areas and these were topic areas they wanted the students trained in. Most importantly, when you're looking at this type of formative evaluation, you're going to see they'll be quite interested, the program coordinators will be interested in that second box of the curriculum, the development and refinement. This was a way that they could, what was in this box was a way that they could actually go in and modify the training program based on the results that we were getting. And one of the things was they felt that the introduction to green building awareness was too long at 40 hours. They wanted it reduced to 24 hours. The other thing they wanted, the weatherization already had a heavy hands-on component, but we know with this type of training that the more hands-on, the better. They want some lecture, but they really want to get out there and do things. They want to sort of put the practices they're learning into place. So there was a heavy emphasis on creating more type exercises within the program to have a more hands-on component. And then finally, in that final box, what we saw was there was an increase in environmental consciousness, that the different stakeholders were saying this was quite important at home and at work. So it helps student achieve greater awareness of environmental issues, including sustainability, but the type of feedback that I was getting, particularly from the students, was not only did they want to do this type of process in their workplace where they wanted to do the green jobs, they also were then going to their houses, their mother's houses, their cousin's house, and also implementing some of that training. So that transferred, which we found quite interesting, not only to their work setting, but also to they really became more environmentally conscious and were making changes within their homes as well. So this just gives you some of the anecdotal information from the perspective of the student and the instructor. And one thing that struck me when I was listening to Charles' talks earlier was we also got some feedback from the Community Advisory Committee saying, right now we don't have jobs because we're waiting on the funding money to come through, but we feel like in the next 6 months we will have more jobs and they will need these courses. Maybe there's not the immediate impact you'd like to see where we can hire them right now, but we know coming down the road there will be. So lessons learned. Well, if you're going to use this type of 360 system, what it allows you is to give all the program stakeholders, all those key informants, a voice in the system. And again, I stress, I think that's very important when you're developing or trying to refine a training system. It encourages communication among the stakeholders. It does, particularly when I'm getting that Community Advisory Committee feedback, it allows those program coordinators to sit down with those folks and really review what they find are key aspects of their program that I'm going to come in and evaluate. But it creates a dialogue of a dialogue between them of how they're developing the curriculum, what they're going to use it for, and how to make it most powerful and have the greatest impact. So it really does encourage communication across the stakeholders. It takes a great deal of cooperation and buy-in. This is a process I've been using for quite a while. This is a process that the program coordinators are now familiar with. But this process couldn't have happened without Cazetta's help, who's the director of the special training programs, because she was the person that encouraged folks behind the scenes of the importance of the evaluation, brought me into meetings so I could sit down and meet people. They could see who I was. I could share the evaluation results and give them feedback. And that was invaluable in this process. I don't think I would have gotten the kind of data I got without Cazetta's involvement in this. Another thing, just keep in mind, multiple stakeholders equals multiple methods. You do not have to have every stakeholder in the process like we did. This is something that we've developed over the years. But if you are, say, going to collect information from community advisory groups or from students and start implementing that into your system, just be aware that you really do have to sit down with the program coordinators and sit down with a few of those folks and find out what is the most efficient way to get that information from them. Again, we get qualitative and quantitative. I am someone who is very, very in favor of having both in the system. I think it's really difficult to understand the numbers if you don't understand the why behind it. And one of the things that's key for this too, also in terms of the cooperation and buy-in, is using the results for program improvement. Every time I conduct this evaluation, I sit down with those key stakeholders and provide that feedback. So they are much more likely to give you information if they see that it's used for something, that they see it's not just gathered and checked off in a report and done. If they see that it's really a part of a continuous improvement process, that they are much more likely to be engaged in the system. And finally, to monitor program progress over time. This is not a one-shot deal. We're going back in 2 years, asking similar questions, and looking as they change these courses, as they streamline the courses, as they try to create courses that are matched to what is going on with the needs of the community, we monitor that over time to make sure we are in the system of continuous improvement.
Wow, that was very powerful. I would like to open up the floor to questions, and I'd like to drill. We have a little time here, and I want to give us the opportunity to drill down on some of these issues. The first one I want to, before I open, I'm going to take the moderator prerogative and toss out the first question. It seems to me that the explosion in the green market and green industry has not really led into employment opportunities, yet we're doing a lot of training for these opportunities. Is this training leading, opening up opportunities for folks to start working? Have there been needs analysis associated with this, the needs for this type of training? And are there successes that we can point to that may lead to better opportunities? And I'd like for you all to come back up if it's possible. And where are the lights?
I'll just take the first stab of it, which is that I think that the economy is still in shambles, is still recovering. I mean, I don't think there's any way around it. I know that in terms of the construction trades, you look at the apprentice programs, and it's a horrendous situation out there. At the same time, there are openings here and there. And, you know, I don't think we can afford to wait and not do these kind of programs until something changes. Hopefully, it's part of that process. But it is probably something we need more needs assessment, and we need more targeting, figuring out where we can do these programs. I don't think there's an easy answer to it, though.
I was going to make kind of a three-pronged approach to the question. One is that there are workplaces that are existing workplaces that are moving into greener technologies, greener manufacturing, or greener use of products. And so the existing workforce is definitely in need of training as they move from one type of health and safety hazards to maybe some additional health and safety hazards. The second are new jobs created by, in a green economy, green type workplace. And again, kind of the experience from the steelworkers has been when those workplaces are hiring people, there's been very little health and safety focus on training matters. It's just get people in, get them to work. And then third are the training for potential jobs. And I think all three of those need to be considered in the question.
Yes.
Does that relate to how they can perhaps
To answer the first part of your question, I think there are three parts, maybe. The soft skills training that was provided, we did not actually provide that. So yes, the first group that went through our training there received it after the technical training. The soft skills training that they provided was, in a way, it was to help them get used to being in a classroom again, because many of these people were older, you know, in their 40s or 50s maybe, and hadn't been in school since high school. So I think that they did some basic math skills, some reading skills, working on a budget. And they worked on resumes too as well. And so yes, I do think that that helped them be competitive in the job market.
In the back, please.
Okay. Yeah, part of the downturn in the economy also, of course, included a large increase in foreclosures resulting in a lot of houses being abandoned and falling apart. So I was wondering if any of these programs are involved in the training of workers to deconstruct homes, where they're going in and taking them apart to salvage the wood, the doors, and all this stuff, and constructing other houses in the future.
Chips. Well, I represent, I guess I work for the laborers, and we do a lot of construction work, and we have just received a Harwood grant on looking at demolition work and deconstruction work. But no, there hasn't been a formalized process yet, and there is still a lot of issues associated with, amongst the trades, with demolition versus deconstruction, because one implies recycling and one means just tearing up the work. And one trade, laborers, we get to tear up all the work, whereas the other trades get to go in and recycle it. So there's always jurisdictional issues associated where we're trying to work through as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that we're seeing that I was trying to touch upon in terms of old economy, new economy, you know, how we create sustainability on both ends of that is what we want to do. And obviously healthy homes and healthy building has to encompass a broad view of how you, don't get rid of what you have that you can reuse and then create things that are safe in what you're building new. And I guess the other thing I wanted to comment on in the earlier part, I think the shovel ready mantra, and this is my personal opinion, that had to be used for political purposes to get the stimulus package passed, of course. But I think what we know from the construction industry or other industries is when you create a project at a local level, and probably the Brownfields process is the best example of this, when you get down into the nitty-gritty of local politics in putting boots on the ground and moving dirt in a municipal area, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. And that stretches to paving a new road or putting up a mall or whatever. So I think that's part of what I think we need to keep focused on, is that if we're going to follow through with a sustainable process to create sustainable development, then we shouldn't fall prey to thinking that there's a shortcut to getting there. And I feel like that's what's so hard about not sustaining the public support to be able to do it. So I guess that's probably our overall message, is that this isn't something that's happening overnight, but when you look down to local communities where you see it happening, that's where the rubber hits the road.
This relates to what Chip just said, but also your original question, Walter, because I've been involved with various groups getting training money in the Puget Sound area, and you hear the complaint, okay, we've got our guys going through the third cycle of yet another training program we got grant money for, none of them still gone out. So my question is, what goes on in our programs to maintain some semblance of hope in with that situation going on?
That's tough.
I was trying to be hopeful myself.
Yeah, I think it's the personal contact. I think for our stimulus grant, it is the site coordinator being somebody who's there in the community where the people who graduated have somebody to come back to, and that person come back to us. On the other hand, financially that's limited given the stimulus grant is gone. So how much we can support that is difficult. I know the other example for us is a Brownfields grant we got in Cincinnati, and it's very time intensive, but again, it's that main staff person who basically helped from beginning to end, interviewing the people, help training the program, helping to place them, but also keeping contact with them day in and day out.
Yeah, hi, my name is Tish Davis, I'm from Massachusetts. I don't really want to distract from the training questions. I think training is my first love, and somehow I ended up being an epidemiologist. I don't know how that happened. But I really want to go back to the Paul Shelfie slide because in the Sentinel Health Event question. Because those of us, and I work with, you know, there's 23 states now funded to do occupational health surveillance through their state health departments. Our FACE programs were targeting green energy deaths and manufacturing and production as a target for the 9 states doing FACE investigations in NIOSH. 5 states have asthma surveillance, and I know there's a lot of interest in the isocyanate-based insulation materials and roofing materials. So somehow I feel I'd like to start a conversation between those of us who are doing surveillance using health data sources, the BLS data, the CFOI data, and those of you involved on this end, to make sure that we're asking the right questions. Like, if there's information you need, I feel like we need to be talking to you. So I just want to put that on the agenda because I think, you know, we need data and we need the Sentinel Health Events to tell the story. So I just...
No, just to respond, I think that's why I was so struck with the slide after the one that Paul did, you know, in terms of when you get down into what we used to call SIC codes, but standard industrial classifications, to be able to get drilled down in data to get employment data to be able to base illness and injury reports on, it's getting very difficult. But then it gets even more difficult, which I think is why we put a lot of work into describing the emerging parts of the economy that might be related to green, that to get a really good data base to work from, it's really hard because actually all of our industrial classifications have all been revamped over the last decade. So that was why one of my campaigns that I had was to try to get an SIC code for hazardous waste operations, but that was 25 years ago, and I lost, you know. So it's not possible, to look across the economy at jobs that are related to exposure to hazardous waste. And of course, when we get into the green sector, it sounds like there's partnership opportunities there to drill down.
For both data, but also for the Sentinel Health Event, the system
We've just had a conversation with BLS on that same topic. They have just collected a lot of data on based on the new green definition, and they have not been looking at health and safety issues. And we brought this up to them 2 weeks ago, and now they're going to go back and see if they can reformulate because they're not going to do another survey. And so they're going to look at they can reformulate the data, begin to drill down to see if there's a potential to make associations with the green industry and a Sentinel Health incident. In the back, please.
David Harrington, California Department of Public Health. Just a general question for the audience and the panelists. Do you see a role for trained grantees to participate in decision-making around the use of safer products in the design of buildings and needs and in sort of project development of architects? You know, there's really good examples out there like Kaiser Hospitals. It's done a lot to sort of like introduce basically mandate that they didn't want any VOC carpets that workers were going to install, that healthcare workers were going to be exposed to, adhesives, products, just a whole range of things that happen at the front end in terms of building design, needs, and how we protect workers who are actually installing those materials as well as workers who are going to be in those buildings.
Does Don Ellenberg want to take that question?
Is he here?
Oh, he's not. No, I was just going to ask Don to address that because that's been an ongoing campaign that we have in conjunction with the Blue Green Alliance is to try to figure out how we bring that into the LEED green building process up front so that that's part of the criteria for figuring out whether something is green or not.
So yeah, we've been doing a lot of work on that, and we're basically trying to move the whole entire process up front. And in construction, we're moving a little bit quicker than some of the other industries because A lot of these safety abatements are more well understood. If we even go beyond just looking at carpets, if we look at built-in fall protection measures, if we're going to be having living roofs now and green roofs, we're going to be putting lots of more folks up on roofs and building roofs. Fall falls is the leading cause of death in construction. We lose about 400 people a year in that. And so what are we doing to make architects aware of the fact that if you're designing to have more folks on roofs, what are you doing to prevent them from falling off of the roofs? And it's an education process. And then there's also the head in the sand approach, because many architects, many engineers, many designers are being advised through lawyers not to involve themselves because of liability issues. We like to believe that there's going to be an amount of enough information that they're not going to be able to use it as a reason to not protect, and they're already designing in that vein already. Next, sir.
My name is Robert Malkin, and I'm with NIOSH. One thing that came to mind with being a Dr. Sarkey is that what you mentioned with Dr. Furr is when they interacted with training a long time ago. And many of the interactive training is with he said, here, don't just show them. Tell them, show them what they're doing. Those are the things listed on the outline that you have. But what I've found is that in many cases, we're dealing, and I think in your industry too, the green industry, small businesses. I mean, you may have 10 guys, if you're lucky, 10 guys. You have a poor guy, an owner, a foreman, and hire a couple of people. And somehow we have to figure out a way to reach those people in the small business world. It's not going to be a union, it's not going to be a big union call or hiring call. It could be a guy and his brother-in-law and his nephew rubbing together, doing this stuff. And it's hard to me. I found in doing a project of pallet makers and also of construction workers, these people, construction workers mostly died from struck by injuries. So you hit by a car. So what does the industry do? Say we're going to make it so they don't have to get out of the truck. They can use these automatic things and just lift it up. Great. But about the industry said that 20% of the time they don't work. If the industry says 20% of the time, it's probably more than that. So why doesn't it work? Well, it spills the stuff on the street when it goes like this. Or they put the truck of the can down and it falls down. It's at an end. So guys get out of the truck anyway and manually replace it. So what did industry do? They said, well, because you have these automatic machines, you don't need two guys in a truck. Well, you need just one guy. So you put the truck in park, he gets out, he walks around, he does it, and he gets struck. So, and that's made be a larger industry. The small industry was the pallet industry. They didn't even want to do my study, even though I said I'll give them a free manual. They just said, forget. And I think the problem is figuring out a way to reach small industry. I think Dr. Burke was right by doing an interactive training type of thing. Right? Actually, if I went to the pallet company and talked to the guy and showed him what to do, that's very labor intensive, and I can't do that. And I don't know what you have. My question is, do you have any ideas?
If I may, I think the issue you're talking about is the issue of safety culture. And the beauty of the green movement is that inherent in the green movement is this protectorate of Mother Earth. So if you're involved in green movement in the industry, you're protecting Mother Earth. If we can extend this concept that if you're involved in green industry, you're protecting Mother Earth, you're sustaining Earth for people, thereby you extend this protection to yourself and your workers. That's something that can be easily understood even on a small business level. Too often we underestimate the ability of small businesses and mom and pops to really grasp health and safety, and if we give them more opportunity, I don't think it would be a problem. Straight back.
Yeah, I would say in response to that too, Steve Hacker, I think that's not the way it's generally going to happen. We have to find ways to get to them in a very, that's a way that's in the course of their operation. I think it's just a different thing. If I may, while I have the floor, I wanted to
please
respond to the other, another thing that you said, said. I think that the this issue of designers, it's worse than that right now, because I'm finding that safety people and green people in the same contract, in the same company, don't really talk to each other that much, even in the best companies. And that's, I think, a first step that we can do a better job of trying to push, is to get those people to understand each other. I worked with this, you know, great green contractor, and we said, you know, what about your safety people? And we had a meeting once, and it became apparent that they sort of knew what each other was doing, but not really, and this was the best. So I think that's a place to start looking.
Yeah, working in silos is going to be the death of us.
Yes.
Scott McAllister, Cal Ocean. I came late, so if I'm repeating something, just second now. As most of you know, the American Reconstitution Reinvestment RO stuff was that there was a very large movement within Federal OSHA to find out where these RO funds were being spent. And one of the things on the list was green companies. And we were supposed to go out and find them and inspect them. These were not complaint inspections. They were probing inspections, which are a little softer than the kind of complaint activity. We couldn't find them. Nobody had a list. The transparency for funding for these things is almost opaque as far as the OSHA organizations, especially in our state. There were leaders, there were people making a lot of speeches, there were cigars smoked and tents erected, and governors attended. But when it came down to actually where were these companies, nobody wanted to tell us where they were. Our chief, Len Welsh, went up to Sacramento to try and shake the trees, come back with some places for us to go, but just wasn't there. Only a couple of pockets full of a couple of outlets, and that was it. So the green movement is being well funded, as all of you know. But when it comes to where we can go for our program inspections, we need more transparency.
Has the OSHA definition helped you? The new definition at BLS, DOL's new definition of green jobs, been instructive?
No.
Okay. More. All right, any other questions? Yes.
I guess a question for Jim. Is there an assumption that green jobs are good jobs? I mean, we keep saying that's our assumption.
That's not been our experience so far. Again, in the three piles we were talking about earlier of kind of the existing jobs that are moving into green something, that's as good of a job, salaries, benefits, working conditions, as it was before, and potentially has some room for improvement. In some of the places, particularly, you know, anecdotal experience of places that were shut down and reopening with some kind of a green manufacturing spin, they're typically starting back several steps from where folks left work. Less wages, less benefits, and poor working conditions. So.
if we can find them.
Well, yeah, you have to find them. The only comment I had about finding the green jobs, I think the same people that are working on the list of workplaces that are using nanomaterials are developing the list of where the green workplaces are. So as soon as we get one or the other should be done.
All right. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for attending.